We're joined today by Professor Gomez, Laura E. Gomez, Professor of Law, Sociology, and Chicano Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles, also the co-founder and faculty director of the Critical Race Studies Program at UCLA. So she knows what she's talking about when she's written the book called Inventing Latinos, A New Story of American Racism. Professor Gomez, I first interested in that title, Inventing Latinos. Why did you pick that title?
Yes. Thank you for that introduction and that first question. So I'm using the word inventing in kind of a playful way, right? Because we think of inventing as about inventing a machine or inventing the internet or something. But in this sense, what I'm capturing is one of the other definitions of invention, which is that we create things. We create not things, but we create ideas. And what I'm suggesting is that if you go back 40 years ago to 1980, when it was the first time there was ever a counting of Hispanics on the U.S. Census, we didn't have this conception of Hispanics and Latinos or Hispanics or Latinos as a group, but we really do today. And so that's kind of the dynamic that I'm capturing with inventing.
What was the process initially to sort of separate and count Latinos, Latinas at that time? What was going on in their culture? We thought this is a group of people that we need to sort of designate.
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and it's actually, you know, got some resonance with the 2020 census, which of course we're in the middle of doing right now. So it goes back to 1970. Now, one thing that a lot of Americans don't realize is before 1970, it wasn't something that you filled out. There was a hired enumerator who came to your house, interviewed the head of household, and put the race data, black, white, American Indian, in themselves, right? It wasn't a self-identification thing. Then 1970, it became no more enumerators. It's self-identification. You're going to fill out this form, and you're going to say what your race is. Well, after the 1970 census results, the federal government was sued by the Mexican American Defense and Legal Fund, and they said there's an undercount of Spanish-speaking people. We need to do better with this. And by the lawsuit actually failed, but what it did was it got the attention of the census officials themselves. And so they began thinking about how to count Latinos and added that category in, added that question, the Hispanic ethnicity question, in 1980 for the first time.
And when you start counting people, then you have these numbers, and people start dealing with numbers, and they sort of say, look at the population in this ethnic group will suddenly reach this level. And as you know, the white population, the main population, the majority of people in the United States, I don't know whether people start thinking that as a, quote, a threat or what it really means, but people can they can manipulate numbers to make whatever point they want to make, I guess.
That is exactly right. So the dynamic is both, it's both to a sense, you know, we had the, after the 1980 census, we started seeing, oh, look at this huge, you know, it wasn't huge at the time compared to what it is now, right? Right now, Latinos are 20% of the U.S. population, and it was much smaller in 1980. But it still was big enough for some people to say, for example, advertisers, right, to say, ah, we have this market, and we need to be doing commercials geared toward this group, whether they're commercials in English that kind of resonate with them, or we need to be doing commercials on Spanish language media, which was mostly radio in 1980. A nice plug for radio right there. But it also, like you said, it generated a fear on the part of some, right? So, for example, former presidential candidate Pat Buchanan saw that those numbers in 1980, and he really began trumpeting some of the rhetoric against Mexicans and against immigrants that Trump capitalized in his campaign and has pursued vigorously as president. So those numbers they kind of create this sense of groupness, and that's kind of getting back to the notion of inventing too, and how we come to see something as inevitable, even though before that, you know, it wasn't necessarily seen that way.
We're talking to Laura Gomez. The book is called Inventing Latinos, A New Source of American Racism. When we think of racism, and even currently now with the issues going on across the United States, we think it usually relates to a black-white issue type of things like that. What kind of racism is there either taking place related to the Latinx community or what we see or maybe not reported or understood?
Right. Well, since it's on a lot of people's minds, right, the police violence that has been so, I think, appropriately magnified by Black Lives Matter, not just this summer. Black Lives Matter as an organization was working for years to bring attention to this problem, right? But if you actually look at the data in places where there are significant numbers of Latinos, like Los Angeles County, for example, since George Floyd was killed on Memorial Day, there have been 7 men killed by the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department in that time. And of those men, it's equal numbers of Latino and African American men. And I should say some of them are minors, so they're children. That's an example of some type of the discrimination.
Is it important for us to sort of separate that, put those in separate categories, or do we kind of deal with all as just a racism, dealing with people would be minorities? That way, I guess.
Well, I think it's both. I think we need to think of it both in terms of how are these dynamics similar, and therefore how can the solution be similar? And policing is kind of an example of that, right? But then we need to think also about specificity and what are the particular dynamics that are involved. So immigration might be an example like that, right? So we know that there are Black immigrants to the United States who are not Latinos, and I should just insert here that there are also, of course, I hope people realize there are Black Latinos, right? But for a moment, I'm talking about a non-Latino Black immigrants from Africa, from the English-speaking Caribbean, and they're not experiencing the dynamics of immigration that, by and large, that we're talking about for the immigrants coming today from Central America in particular, and Mexico, and some parts of the Caribbean, right? Spanish Caribbean. So I think it's both, to answer your question.
A lot of this comes down sometimes to skin color. You know what I mean? I guess when they refer to brown, that's when they say, you know, they list colors or whatever.
Yeah,
that's
black and brown, yeah.
That's kind of what they're referring to for the Latino community then, related to that.
Yeah, I think brown could also, you know, sometimes I use that term just in language, sometimes talking to my students, and I'm using it as a catch-all because other people are brown too, right? So some Asian Americans are brown, right? South Asians, Filipinos in particular, but even other groups of Asians. And, you know, so brown kind of can cover a lot of ground metaphorically. But one of the dynamics that I discuss in the book is colorism. And colorism is the preference for lighter skin in any group, right? So you see that in a variety of groups, and you certainly have seen it and see it today and historically in the African American community as well. But it's very powerful in the Latino community as well, partly because Latinos they have Spanish ancestry, they have indigenous ancestry, and they have African ancestry because the Spanish imported so many slaves from Africa into the Americas to basically loot the Americas of silver and gold and other resources, many of the first world foods that we love most today. I'm thinking about, you know, coffee and chocolate, right, came from the Americas and were taken to Europe.
Let's talk a little bit about Puerto Rico. We have a large Puerto Rican community in the Lorraine County area. They all came here for jobs some decades ago, whatever, as well.
Right.
Why do you think that Puerto Rico should be granted statehood? What's your thoughts on that?
Yes. I absolutely think that is long overdue. And the reason is because we've had Puerto Rico for now 120 years in a colonial status. And it means that Puerto Ricans, for example, Puerto Ricans have the one thing that's different from Mexicans and Central Americans who immigrate is Puerto Ricans are not immigrants, right? They can come and go freely between the island and the mainland. And once they come to the mainland, they are eligible just as any other citizens of the United States to vote for president. But on the mainland, on the island, Puerto Ricans cannot vote for president, and they have limited rights in a lot of other ways. And this has certainly been brought into sharp relief after Hurricane Maria and the PROMESA, which is the debt program. It's a federally administered debt program that is forcing austerity rather than having self-determination for how they're going to handle their economy and so forth. They're in this limbo land. If they had been a state, they would have been able to go into bankruptcy and get the protections that bankruptcy offers. We don't have time to go into it in great detail, but Puerto Ricans have been coming to the mainland in significant numbers since the early 20th century, and in very large numbers since during and after World War II, when there was recruitment of Puerto Rican labor, and maybe some of the population there in Lorain County comes from that time period, because there were two different programs to take workers from Puerto Rico to the mainland.
We are talking today with the Professor of Law, Sociology, Chicana Studies, University of California, Los Angeles, Laura Gomez, author of the book Inventing Latinos, A New Story of American Racism. I just was curious to what some of your students and maybe even a new generation of Latinos, what their thought is, what their place is in the world, what experiences they need or are bringing from their upbringing that we can look forward to.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. So let me start by just taking it back to, you know, when we got those 1980 results, I talked about how some people reacted. But the other thing that happened, and it's been happening for 40 years, is Latinos see those numbers and they have a greater sense of themselves and a greater group consciousness, right? And part of why I'm writing this book is for a Latino audience, because I've seen with my past books and with my speaking across the country that Latinos are really hungry for their history, for their stories, and for good and bad stories, the bad ones being about the history of discrimination against Puerto Ricans and Mexican Americans in the 20th century up until the 2000s, and the histories of many groups since then, right? So people are really hungry and I think excited about learning. And I hope that, you know, some of it inspires a future generation of book writers and professors and teachers in K-12 and all of that. So that would be my hope.
If people are interested in finding out more about your book or some of the topics, where's a good place for maybe them to get some more information on this?
Yes, they should go to my website, www.lauraegomez.com.
Sounds good. Professor Gomez, appreciate your time this morning. Thanks for sharing this insight with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.